Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome back to our continuing series on Dharma, presented by Professor G. Venkatraman. Professor Venkatraman sir is here in our studios, and if you remember, last week we presented Professor's 9th talk in this series, and today we'll be bringing you a question and answer session based on Professor's earlier talks in this series, including the 9th one that was presented last week. And the questions will be posed by a panel, and the panelists today are Professor Peter Prusen from Denmark and Radio Sai's Bishu Prasthi. And as always, Professor Venkatraman will be answering and clarifying the questions put up by the panelists. So today, over to Bishu for his first question in this session. Over to you, Bishu.
Thank you, Sunil. All these sessions of question and answer that we have had in this series, we used to have questions posed by Aman Javeri, and we had once Hari Shankar, and the last few episodes we've been fortunate to have Professor Peter Prusen also from Denmark. And every time we request listeners to send their questions. So I was thinking, if it is okay with you, sir, shall we take some of the questions that the listeners have posed?
Sure.
Because there are so many. So maybe we can take a couple of them, and then we can have Professor Prusen take it further after that. So one question which has come recently is from a devotee in the U.S. He says that in their study circles, they have discussed on this topic of love. And as part of this discussion, the aspect of criticism came in the discussion, and they were trying to understand how to handle criticism, how criticism is an obstruction when you're trying to practice love all, serve all. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, the question is not clear enough for me, but I'll assume the question is the following and then try to answer. Let us say there is A, who is trying to love all and serve all. And it so happens he is engaged with B, whom he is trying to serve and love or whatever. And B finds fault with A. This happens often. How do you deal with it? Do you believe that is the question?
Yeah, I think...
Can we interpret it that way?
Sure.
Okay. Professor, do you think that's a fair way of going ahead with the question? Okay, so I have two yeses, which means unanimous, and I'll give the answer as follows. I will take the view that when we do this, engage in this sadhana of love all, serve all, first of all, the important point is before we love or serve, we must be able to see God in the other person. In other words, in this case, A must imagine that B is really God come in disguise. There are any number of stories to corroborate that God can come in any form, and the story of the dog and Shirdi Baba is well known, so I won't recount it. So if A says, well, it is not Mr. B who is criticizing me, although B may be criticizing because he is body conscious. If A says, I don't pay attention to that criticism, it's actually Swami is using B as an instrument to tell me that I'm all not that great, there are flaws in me, that I must change my attitude. I'm really not seeing God in B, because if I saw God in B, I wouldn't take objection to the criticism. Normally, when Swami scolds us, we do feel bad, but we don't criticize Swami in return. So, criticism with another criticism. We don't volley back. So, it is a question, I would say, basically, A must examine his sadhana and try to improve it. Looks like I'm not seeing God in B. And I'm just getting a signal that I must improve my performance. If that attitude is taken, it's not easy. How you can't say, if people make a very clear distinction between Swami and the rest of the world. If Swami says come at this time, they will come 10 minutes earlier. If you tell A, B, C, D, E, the whole universe to come at a certain time, they will come staggering slowly. Though this happens, we know it. We do it here also. So the sadhana, love all, serve all, must start by seeing God in the others. And just to remind that we must do this, Swami says, Sarva Jiva Tiraskaram Kesavam Prajigachati. That means, no, anybody whom you abuse, that abuse doesn't go to that person, it comes through that conduit to me. Essentially, you are abusing me. Same way, in this case, if you get hurt by the criticism of me, that means you are not seeing God in me. That is where the sadhana must be changed.
Could I add a...
Definitely, the floor is
a
open.
A personal experience. A number of times I've had my students present a paper and ask the other students to come with criticism. Much of the time, they praise it and they say it was very good, and they don't take the opportunity to really help the other person by coming with criticism. And I ask them, I say, why don't you do this? And they say, well, because we're told that criticism is not good, we should love all and serve all. And I tell them they make a mistake. If they really want to love and serve the other person, then they help them. Criticism is not just something negative. It can definitely be supportive.
I will add a rider to that. See, it depends on the circumstances. If somebody who is not connected with it come and criticizes, that is a different situation. But here, when you ask a person to play a critical role, and they like to be nice, that is negligence of duty. On the other hand, I'll tell you my experience. I asked them to make a presentation, and I am auditing it, and I make criticism, and the boys say, you are demotivating us. I am supposed to be the coach. And if the coach cannot tell what is wrong with the presentation, then who has the right? So, and this is endemic in this country. And there was a famous incident when the Indian team had an excellent coach, a former Australian player, and he was fired because the player did not like his criticism. He said, I was just doing my duty. So, on the other hand, if I tell him something, somebody comes and criticizes me, what business do you have to tell him this and that? That is poking his nose.
Yes.
But you as a teacher wanted your students to learn the art of refereeing.
Yes.
And they were not happy about doing that. They were ducking the job.
Absolutely.
So, that is a fault.
Yes.
But I am now here tying criticism to the sadhana of love all, serve all.
Yes.
And I say, if you are not able to see God in me, then you better forget about your sadhana. There is something fatally wrong with it.
Yes. I remember one quote which says that feedback is the breakfast of champions.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to all the time welcome feedback.
That depends on who is giving the feedback.
Yeah. No, if it is coming from a person, as you rightly said, if that person we feel is competent enough to give us feedback, for example, you know, if you are a writer and another writer gives you a feedback, then I think you have to look at it constructively. But if someone is a football player and he comes and gives you some feedback about something which, even though negative,
yeah,
you can always take it like...
You know, you are talking about the worldly thing. I am talking in respect of the sadhana.
Yeah.
Worldly, where worldly matters are concerned, the opinions vary. I can like it, I can dislike it,
yes,
and so on and so forth. So, with respect to the sadhana, I think my answer is, it seems it is passé. Okay.
And there's also the aspect of how the criticism is given.
Yes.
If you
that's
cruel,
true. That's absolutely true.
That's
because, na bruyat satyam apriyam. What may be true, don't deliver it harshly.
Correct.
Gently you say it.
Yes.
If I were you, I would not do it this way. Mm. There is this problem. Why don't you pay attention to it?
Exactly. Mm.
Absolutely.
That's absolutely true. I don't have the time, but there is a Japanese way of doing this. Remind me in some other talk, I'll tell you about it. That's really a big learning lesson.
And taking on from criticism, there's another leading question about how once a washerman criticized Lord Rama and what Lord Rama did. The famous question which many times youngsters of today also ask.
Hey, this is pretty old.
True, but... there are many questions in Ramayana which people question and they find answers to, but this is one question which many times even learned scholars don't find, are not able to give a very convincing.
You are talking
reply.
Of Rama sending Sita for the second time to forest,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Okay, this is a FAQ, frequently asked question.
Yes.
I have answered this a zillion time.
Mm-hmm.
This is a zillion plus one time if you have finished asking me the question.
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. Why Lord Rama paid an attention to the washerman's words and sent Sita to the forest, though he knew that it was purely washerman's ignorance? How to understand the subtle dharma behind the situation?
The person asking the question If that person reads Valmiki Ramayana correctly, Rama answers that question right at the time when he does the Agni Pariksha. If you recall, Agni Pariksha is the test by fire that Rama conducts. Basically, after the war is over, Rama tells Sita is brought decked and all that, yes, in a palanquin, and she is walking towards Rama. She says, stop. Rama says, stop. You are supposed to be my wife, but you have lived in another man's house. According to our traditional practices, I cannot accept you. You are free to go wherever you want. Then she asks Lakshmana to write a fire, light a fire, and the fire roasts, and she goes round and she gets into the fire. But fire refuses to burn. Then when she comes out, Rama tells her, Sita, it was not that I did not know your purity. I know who you are and I know you are pure. But I have to silence the world. So, this is my first point. Second point is, Swami has said on a couple of occasions, and one of them I have heard myself, that Ramayana should not be read linearly as a story. He says it is a story where God came down in human form, separated his energy aspect into the female form, and he was Paramatma, the consciousness, and she was Prakriti or nature. They played the role of consciousness and energy. And in that drama they get separated. And everything was a lesson. So the sending her away was also a lesson. Lesson to whom? To future generations. For example, in this country, there are any number of rich people and politicians who make sure after them their sons will get into the positions of power. It happens in corporations, it happens in the political field, and so on and so forth. Which reminds me, and this is a pretty old affair, it's nothing new. It reminds me of a cartoon that appeared in Times of India, where a father is beating his son. He is teaching lessons in geography. And in those days, Japan used to be called the land of the rising sun, S-U-N. Sun rises in the east and first shines. And the father, the son is saying, Daddy, India is the land of the rising sun, S-O-N. All the suns are rising. He beats him, don't you know geography? So, it is a message to all these fellows, don't be infatuated with your children like Dhritarashtra was. You are in the seat of power. You must be seen to be neutral and far away from them. Send them away. T.T. Krishnamacharya did that. He was a minister, first generation minister. He was a congressman. He was a rich man. He was a businessman, but he was also a congressman. And he held important positions. Once, for no fault of his, he assumed a responsibility and he resigned from the ministership. Since he was a businessman, his sons were also involved in business. When he was asked to become the finance minister, he renounced his business. He also renounced his sons. He said, they are separate from me. I have no connection with them. When he came to Madras, he lived separately. He had their ancestral house. I've been to that. And he said, I've got my relatives. I'll go and stay with them. I won't stay with my son. Because it will be seen as being partial in favor.
Yeah, but
he took it seriously.
Yes. As you mentioned.
So, in short, yes, there are a number of lessons in Ramayana. They were enacted by the Lord and his consort in human form as lessons for us. So all these things must be seen as lessons. Supposing you go to a drama, and in the drama, the man who acts as Rama sends that lady who acts as Sita to the forest. You don't weep about it, you don't criticize it, because it's a drama.
True.
So, for them this is a drama. We don't realize it's a drama. So we apply the kind of rules that we apply to ourselves.
No, but as you mentioned, your first point.
It's also a lesson for us.
True. Rama very clearly told Sita that, you know, I wanted to silence the world, and that's the reason why I want you to go through the fire. So Rama had no issues, and to the world also he had displayed about Sita's purity.
No, but
purity.
The people's feeling is,
but just
why do you have
one washerman had a problem, should...
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just because one washerman, and perhaps who's very ignorant of Sita's purity, and no clue about what she's talking about, and about whom he's talking about, and Rama is convinced, the rest of the subjects are convinced, if one person has an
objection... How do you know the rest of the subjects are convinced?
Okay, largely, we can say, I don't know. Yeah, that is true. But maybe a large people, because in front
all
of
right,
everyone...
What is your question?
Yeah, my question is, should Rama pay attention to one ignorant washerman's comment and leave Sita to the forest? The and especially the time when
that's
she was...
That's why I told you it's a lesson for the Kali age. Dog, the divine gives lesson for all ages. In this age, if you do one mistake, which is not very serious, the world says, why you should do this? What is the special privilege? Right now, the big thing that is going on in America is about Mrs. Hillary Clinton having a private email account while being the Secretary of State. Apparently, it was allowed within the law. Then they said, why should she have it? Why does she release the emails one by one? And she chooses, she picks and chooses. Why can't she give the server to someone else? Let them do it. All sorts of questions. So, when you hold high office, as the journalists say, you are fair game. It is not a question of one man may say it, but in today's Twitter world, the whole world will be saying this. Therefore, Caesar's wife must be pure and must be seen to be pure. Yes. If I remember, that was a statement way back in the days of Julius Caesar.
So here he acted more as an ideal king than an ideal husband.
Absolutely. In fact, if you go back to the story of Ramayana which Swami has narrated, in the mantra that you are supposed to chant at the time of wedding, there is a mantra saying, I'll please my wife. And Rama says, I won't chant this mantra to the priest. I have to protect my people. I am here to serve my people and be the king. And their interests will come first. I will have to please them. The wife is secondary. Attecha, kamecha, and all those mantras. Swami has said it many times.
Yes.
Because he has come to play a role, be a role model. And the role model he decided to be. In fact, he never declared his divinity, although it was visible on a few occasions.
When he's sensitive to what the subject's feelings are. And as an ideal...
Actually, in those days there was no Facebook, Twitter, there was really no problem. But he was giving a lesson for all time. Yes. He knew that a day when Facebook would come, Twitter would come, Instagram would come, I don't know what else would come. And he was preparing us for that. Because today we are swept by that. We don't ask if it is true. You must prove yourself. You should not have done this, even though you may be right. Because others can do the same thing. What is so great about you? So I think we should get back to our mainstream. We have been given enough time.
Perhaps answers the question.
So I think
you are great expert.
You have come with a long list of questions or some comments.
Yes, I have. Let me just, one of them, I'll tie directly into what we just talked about.
Oh, good. That's nice.
Again, referring to this most recent chapter in Das's book, where he focuses and contemplates different approaches to the concept of duty. And in particular, he focuses on intentions on the one hand and on consequences on the other hand. And Das then states on page 72, he states the following, I quote, "The ethics of absolute standards and perfection appeals more to those who are far removed from public office, like Yudhishthira when he lived in the forest." I mention that because it's directly related to what you've just mentioned about Hillary Clinton, about people who are being in the limelight and whatnot. So again, repeat, the ethics of absolute standards and perfection appeals more to those who are far removed from public office, like Yudhishthira was when he lived in the forest. Do you have any comments on that?
Yes, I know what you're talking about. When we talk of ethics and morality, it is not a question of what I like in the morning, what I like in the evening. I have to ask myself, am I committed to doing right and avoiding wrong selectively as convenient or in a non-negotiable manner?
Yes.
There are, in public life, the leader is expected to be non-compromising and sometimes it's very harsh. I'm not talking of absolutely moral issues, but even issues that are not moral. Mm-hmm. Why doesn't, for example, I heard people say in America, why doesn't the president get angry? Actually, a good leader should be calm. A man who is angry cannot lead.
Cannot
that is
decisions.
Known to people who are scholars and who are leaders. You don't lose your cool. The moment you lose your cool, you are a useless leader. But the public is so rattled by something or the other that has happened. I don't see the president getting angry. He should be boiling mad, hopping mad over this. That is a chest-thumping redneck who would do that.
Yes.
So there is ignorance on one side. So my question is, what is it I am committed to? Gandhi did not live in a forest. Gandhi was in the thick of the battle. He said, it may be very inconvenient for me, but I am going to adhere to absolute standards. I don't care what others say. He said on one occasion, the whole world may turn against me and tell me I'm an idiot for believing in God. Let them say, it is their view. I believe in God and I'm going to stay with that belief. I cannot be changed. Nobody can take my self-respect away from me unless I surrender it. So there are people. Now, it turns out that if a large number of people were to have that faith at least 70% of the time, it will be a substantial improvement. What is our alternative? In the name of concessions, we have got into what you call a situation where wars have become very common. We don't learn lessons from one war. We don't learn lessons from famines. We don't learn lessons from mistakes. And the privileged get away and the unprivileged don't get away. We have a lot of inequity and we pretend we don't know how to fix it. Because the way of fixing it is inconvenient to us.
I give an example built directly upon what you're saying. This is from I read the Danish newspaper on the internet this morning. And there's an article about a conflict that is brewing between Sweden and Saudi Arabia. Sweden, which has had some large contracts with Saudi Arabia, in particular to help it with military aspects, has recently been very critical of Saudi Arabia in respect to human rights. And this has now led to Saudi Arabia now pulling out of its contracts. And they interviewed the head of the Swedish Business Association. He was very upset, saying this is very poor. We're losing all these contracts, not only with Saudi Arabia, but with also other countries. A total disregard of the moral aspects, the non-negotiable aspects. We don't learn.
Rather interesting you point this out, because some years ago, the exact opposite of this happened. You may remember that Britain had a very big, massive defense deal with Saudi Arabia. And the public was very critical about Saudi Arabia for whatever reason, I don't recall. And then Tony Blair, the Prime Minister, bent backwards to protect the image of Saudi Arabia because he said 10,000 jobs are at stake.
Yes.
So, he said, no, Saudi Arabia is a friend in many occasions. We cannot let down friends. Yes, friends have faults. We must talk to them. And we do talk to them about these things. But you can't abandon people just on sort of all sorts of things. We have to look after our interests also and so on and so forth. In fact, that is the central theme of the Mahabharata, if you remember. Thus is always saying, I don't want to get hurt. But that doesn't mean I should accept nonsense. So how do I draw the line? That is the question that is being asked. And the question, the answer is, you have norms. And the question is, what norms? Absolute norms or relative flexible norms? That is where the issue is. And unless people make a decision, we will not have any progress. And progress cannot come towards what I would call dharma. Unless I have absolute standard. The moment I reject that, then we are forever in a soup.
And that is where Das is also challenging Yudhisthira, because he says when you are living in the forest, you are able to take these very powerful, strong views, but now that things are approaching and you know that you're being cheated again, you're willing to go into law, into war.
No, actually he didn't go to war at that time.
No.
What happened was, he accepted the terms and conditions laid down. He went to the forest and 12 years in the forest, 1 year incognito, and he came out of it. But those fellows said, no, we saw you before that. There was a dispute as to whether they were detected, that disguise was penetrated before the clock time or after it. And then they refused to give the land. Then there was negotiation, and Yudhishthira was prepared to make a concession. He says, all right, don't give a kingdom. Give us 5 villages to live in. And the answer that came was, we won't give you 5 pinheads of land, you get 0. And at that point of extreme unreasonableness, they said that it is not anything wrong to fight. That was Yudhishthira's decision. And the post-war era, I think Yudhishthira was basically a man who was dharmic in his heart. After all, he was the son of Dharma. Dharmaputra he was called. He might have strayed slightly away from the GPS route here and there. But amongst others, I would say he was closer to the track of Dharma than others. But he had a way of making mistakes and repenting. For all his wisdom, he was a poor planner, strategist. Yes. That was his weakness. So I would downgrade him a bit, but I won't call him junk bots.
Now that we're talking about this concept of war, one of the things that I would like to ask you, which amazes me, is we are told both in the Mahabharata and in the Gita that there were rules of war, that certain norms you had to live up to. You could not just kill wantonly. There were certain rules. And when I think of the way humanity has developed, I think, go back to the Second World War. People have a tendency to focus, and it's quite reasonable, upon the atomic bombs being dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But is not understood is that prior to that, in the month prior to that, the Allies dropped firebombs on major cities in Japan that killed far more people than were killed in the 2 huge atomic bombs. You know, and these were not aimed, as was the case with the atom bombs, they were not aimed at military installations. They were aimed at where people were living. In other words, if we go back several thousand years ago, people had norms of ethical behavior, even in war, and today, apparently, we have just thrown it all away.
You see, this is what happens with what is called the slippery slope. The bombs, aerial bombing was introduced by the Germans in World War I because they had the gas balloon planes.
Yes.
Made by Hindenburg, if I remember correctly. When it came to World War II, incidentally, just 2 days ago was the anniversary of the Tokyo firebombing, just 2 days ago. Over 330 B-29 bombers dropped bombs throughout the night. And Tokyo was built out of bamboo at that time. 25 square kilometers, 5 kilometer by 5 kilometer square. Whole night they dropped bombs, over 10,000 bombs. And there were fierce winds. You know, once a fire starts, it swirls, creates a local vacuum. And in that, over 100,000 people died. That is almost the number in Nagasaki. And they died of fire.
Yes.
And one girl who survived, and she survived, she started burning because other dead people fell on her. She was buried between 8 people. Her voice was heard. So the similarly, Dresden firebombing, whose anniversary was celebrated a few days ago,
yes,
a couple of months ago,
yes,
because
yes,
it was before the end of the German war.
Also horrible.
Also horrible. Now, that was to teach a lesson. And nowadays, they have sanitized it by saying collateral damage. We really aim at the target. There are so-called, what are called pseudo-Geneva conventions, thou shall not do this, but everything is violating the breach. So the question is, why war? We have never answered that.
No.
If you look at the Charter of the United Nations, 1944, they signed it in San Francisco. India was a founding member,
yes,
because British India signed it on behalf of India. So we were a member right from then. And it says to abolish war forever or something like that.
Yes.
that the horror of two wars, scourges that devastated humanity in this century. But if you look at the statistics, the number of people who have died due to conflicts and war and genocide after Second World War equals, if not exceeds, the number of people who died in Second World War.
Yes.
What have we learnt after so much of expenditure?
Mm.
We have not, because the war machine is a good business investment. So, if there is money in it,
absolutely,
we are not going to give it.
There was the president of the United States was after the war was Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Yes.
And he was perhaps not one of the greatest American presidents. He was the commander-in-chief of the Allied forces during the Second World War.
In the West.
In the West, yeah. And by the way, now the two of us are demonstrating our age. I don't think that Bishop Christie probably knows very much about this. But he was president, and when he left, he made a famous speech.
Yes, I remember that.
And he said, maybe this is not completely verbatim, not word for word, but he said, beware of the military-industrial
complex.
A president who was a general, knowing better, having first-hand information, warning the American people, beware of the affiliation of the military with its huge budgets and the military and the government.
See, we must see two things in that. Eisenhower came from Kansas, I believe, which is an agricultural state. And he was quite a religious man, though he erred on certain sides in his private life. And he took the Christian teachings seriously. The second thing, he, as president, swore allegiance to the Constitution. This military-industrial complex which he described, which I don't have time to go into, essentially was an instrument of the market that was intended to subvert democracy.
Yes.
And he did not like the foundation of America to be destroyed by some short-circuited market philosophy. Short-circuiting market philosophy. So he warned the nation, your democracy is in peril. And prior to him, Justice Brandeis of the Supreme Court, he said, you can either have capitalism or democracy, not both.
Yes.
So we see here the beginnings of the virus raising its hood. And today there are so many industrial complexes, the pharma industrial complex, the education industrial complex, and so on, the list goes. So the power of money, at some point, money becomes more powerful than morals.
Yes. I remember some time back you had written a very enlightening article, Men, Morality, Men, Money, and Morality or something.
Men, Money, Myth, and Morals.
Men, Money, Myth, and Morals. Yes, so many. I think as we are running out of time, I think I should request the listeners to read that article. If you just search on our website. All you have to do is just search on the website and it will just show up. And probably that will help us to dwell a little more on this connection between money and morality, which is so very relevant and something that all of us should be discussing and
in quantum mechanical language, they don't commute. You may probably understand what I say.
Is there time for another question, Bishop?
Maybe a quick question.
Okay. In your last musings, you referred extensively to some of these famous so-called Enlightenment philosophers. These were people who were reacting to a great extent against the traditional lines of authority in the West, the Catholic Church, the monarchy, and they were putting reason, analysis, and individualism in the high seat. It's interesting that at the same time, science was making great progress. That was the scientific revolution was being spearheaded by...
From the time of Galileo.
Yeah, Galileo and then Newton.
Newton, of course.
Yeah. And also, technology was important because in the previous century, the printing press had been developed. And that enabled these ideas to be spread at a far greater or quicker pace than earlier. The question I have is the following. When the Gita was spoken and the Mahabharata was written, how was that communicated? They didn't have printing press. We all have that today, but was it something that were the that people?
It's a very good question you are asking. You see, the Gita was very abstract, so it was kept to the scholarly community. It was written on palm leaves. They were copied and they were transmitted, and people came at different times. They studied and commented. For example, Adi Shankara has written a big, extensive commentary on the Gita. After him came Ramanuja, and he did not agree with Shankara, so he reinterpreted the Gita. Essentially, it had to connected. It was connected with Advaitam and steps to Advaitam. I won't go into all that. This is the scholarly tradition. But the Mahabharata and Ramayana, which are epics, itihasas, they are called, historical stories. The original Sanskrit was, especially Mahabharata is a voluminous book. It is twice the size of the Greek epics,
yes.
Das says. And it is believed it was written at different times. Whatever it is, they were presented, or from them were there were derivatives, not financial derivatives. The derivatives came via music, musical oration, harikatha, folk dramas, folk songs, and so on. And their incidents in the Mahabharata would be portrayed. Incidents in the Ramayana would be portrayed. There would be discourses on that. This Rama going to the forest. There will be a discourse on that. So why did he go to this forest? One who could have ruled. There will be a principle taught. So, and just as Charles and Mary Lamb rewrote Shakespeare, there are many other things. So it's almost like how Shakespearean plays spread themselves. These epics spread themselves through culture in every language. One of my most amazing experiences is, it is a routine, simple experience, but it hit me very hard. When I first came to Swami more than 2.5 decades ago, I had to take a train to Hyderabad. So the short route was to go to Dharmavaram station. He didn't have Puttaparthi station. Anyway, we had to go to Dharmavaram. But take a meter gauge train that in 8 hours would take me to Hyderabad. But I had to wait. It would come at 10:45 from Tirupati, meter gauge, steam engine. And it was cold. So there was a small tribal group. They had lit a fire and they were singing in their dialect stories from the legends. So this is the way it had percolated in all over India. That is that percolation that kept the spirit of truth, dharma and all that alive amongst common people. Swami's family came from people who stays as street drummers.
Yes.
That's why his grandfather had a stentorian voice and he used to play a particular part. Swami has talked about it. So it is through culture and tradition that values are preserved, and temple rituals, tradition. Tradition, culture, music, art, they helped us keep the thing. Now that is all getting shattered.
Thank you for a wonderful answer.
So I think the time is running out, so we will have to...
It always runs out.
Draw the curtains on this segment.
Unless you stop that clock.
So over to Sunil.
Sairam, dear listeners, that brings to an end the 14th question and answer session based on Professor G. Venkatraman's earlier talks in this new series based on Dharma. We hope you like this session, and next week we'll be continuing the present series. Please don't forget to tune in then, and we shall alert you in advance with web and radio announcements about what's coming up in the next week. We thank you for listening, and as always, the podcast of this program may be accessed via our website www.radiosci.org. And dear listeners, your questions and feedback are valuable to us. You may write to listener@radiosci.org. And coming up next on Thursday Live is the segment Service, Love in Action with Raghu. Please stay tuned. Thank you, and Jai Sairam.